At 10 a.m. on February 1st last year, King Gyanendra of Nepal took over the airwaves and announced that he was dissolving the government and taking over the rule of the country. Within minutes of the announcement, all communication systems in the country were shut down by the Royal Nepali Army, and all civil rights were revoked. In the year since the coup, the civil war in the country has continued unabated, and the economy is on the point of collapse. Maddie Burnaby was teaching in Nepal at the time of the coup, and she remained in the country until July of last year. Maddie's been active in the Tibetan human rights movement since 1989. She's a high school teacher in Vancouver, and she joins me in the studio this morning. Hi, Maddie.
Hi.
What was the pretext the king gave for taking over power?
Well, the country's been involved in a civil war since 1996, and the civil war has become increasingly violent, and there has been a democratically elected government. There are issues with that as well, but his excuse or his rationale on February 1st was that by taking over the government, the democratically elected government had ceased to be effective, and somebody needed to take over to bring peace to the country, and he was the man to do it. Now, so that was his rationale.
Did he have any implication in whether the democratic system had succeeded or not?
That's definitely the feeling of most people in Nepal. He actually orchestrated the downfall. And, you know, officially that's not the case, but all of the, you know, journalists that I know, you know, everybody I know, including foreign diplomats, really feel that King Gyanendra created the downfall of the government, and then this coup had been planned for months. It had to have been planned for months in advance. It was too well orchestrated.
And what happened immediately after the coup?
Well, literally within minutes. I was actually at work that day. I was teaching in the American school there. So we knew that there was to be an announcement at 10 o'clock. The king was going to go on the radio. And people had suspicions about what it might be, but, you know, we had to wait to hear. At 10 o'clock, he went on the radio and within a few minutes of his speech, he said that he was taking over and civil rights would be revoked. Freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, and of course, as I said, the communication systems were cut off. Telephone, internet, cell phone, mobile phone, those kinds of things. So literally within a minute, there was freedom of speech, and then there was no freedom of speech. The implications for that, in particular for journalists, were really interesting because suddenly they couldn't write freely, they couldn't speak freely. The army literally went into the newspaper and television offices and stood by and censored everything that was written and said. Journalists were arrested. Human rights and peace activists were arrested. So, you know, the claim of bringing peace to the country, you know, wasn't borne out, because the first people targeted were actually the people who were working towards bringing a democratic peace.
Well, let's back up a moment then. You mentioned that the civil war started in 1996.
Yes.
Why did it start?
That goes back even further, and there's a long history to it. Nepal is a Hindu kingdom. Up until 1990, it was royal rule. It was not a democracy. In 1990, there was a revolution, and a form of democratic government was brought in. There were holes in that. So there were elections, but there are a number of aspects that a democratic government should have that were not brought in, and a number of human rights laws were not properly instituted. So by 1996, there was growing frustration. There were improvements in terms of freedom of speech, so people were starting to be able to argue and defend and look outward and look inward, decide what they wanted, but the government was not providing it. So a rebel group started, and it's become quite violent. It initially wasn't so violent, and the group calls themselves Maoist, and they were demanding, they brought a number of demands to the government, many of which were things like promising education to all, promising rights for women, really, you know, bringing some basic fundamental human rights to all, regardless of, you know, gender, ethnic group, religion, etc. and the government did not comply. And, you know, the democratically elected government was still dominated by high caste, wealthy Nepalese. So that's really when the civil war started. You know, a group of people, particularly from the villages, who felt that even though it was a democratic government, still the needs of the people were not being served, and it was still being controlled by an elite few.
And this is taking place in a country, in a context where there's a lot of very deep poverty.
Very deep poverty, yes, and abysmal literacy rates. I believe it's still about... It's in the, depending who's counting, maybe in the 50% range, but much less for women. There are certain laws that, even the citizenship laws are patriarchal. So if you can't identify your father, you'll have trouble claiming citizenship. And then most of your rights are, you know, you don't have the right to go to college, to, you know, to work legally. There are a number of things you just can't do. So... you know, there are real claims, you know, for concern around the structure of the government even before the king took over.
So when this when the Maoists began their civil war in 1996, were they well supported by people in rural areas?
Definitely. Well, yeah, I would say so. And there's ongoing debate about that, but right now the Maoists effectively control about 80% of the land of Nepal. There's a definite feeling of Kathmandu and everywhere else. So Kathmandu is controlled by the elite, by the army, by the government, and their army everywhere. And I lived in Kathmandu, so there was this superficial feeling of security, kind of, except that there were a lot of army with guns, so that never leaves your conscience. The village is quite different. The Maoists were supported. Many people did join the Maoists. Over the years, the situation on both sides became more desperate and more brutal. So over the last, you know, since 2001, in that time, there are more incidents in which the Maoists are being accused of forcibly abducting people into their ranks. Currently, as we speak, I'm getting reports from friends in Nepal, and there is an election scheduled for February 8th that it's, sounds like virtually everyone in the country is against, because the only people running are the king's friends, basically. And the Maoists aren't allowed to run. The party, the democratic political parties, are boycotting. And it sounds like right now virtually everybody is would rather the Maoists were given, you know, some stand, you know, a footing to stand in and a place at the table. So they're bringing some important concerns.
Now, I mentioned in my introduction that the economy has virtually collapsed. Yeah. What were the causes of that?
There's a huge one is tourism, huge. And the, you know, with tourists don't flock to countries in the midst of a civil war, and that's just understandable. February 1st last year, that really got much worse. For most of the civil war, for tourists, the war has been an inconvenience. It's horrific for Nepalese that their country is in the midst of this mess, but, you know, as an obvious foreigner, I'm Caucasian, so I have blue eyes. I'm an obvious foreigner. I'm not being targeted in any way, shape, or form. You know, there were a few incidents while I was in Nepal, and, you know, I was the only Caucasian person walking down the street, and there's sort of a, you know, bonfires, there are things happening. Nepalese who did not know me made sure that I stayed clear. They, you know, really are very protective. They don't want, you know, foreigners to be hurt. But so for the most part, most governments were telling foreigners to be careful, but it was okay to come. As of February 1st, they could no longer do that. So even the Canadian government put a travel advisory for Nepal and said, we can't be sure that communications are going to stay open. So if you go into the mountains and get hurt or something happens, and if the government cuts off all the phone lines again, we can't help you. So, and it's become more unpredictable. So really, tourism has virtually collapsed with the shutdown in communication and the fact that it's just unreliable. A number of businesses that rely on internet are, you know, and foreign exchange, those kinds of things, trade, they've really collapsed. And so it's really tough for the majority of Nepalese. Many are leaving the country to try to scrape together some work elsewhere.
Yeah. What's been the reaction internationally to the coup and also to the repression that's followed the coup?
Most countries internationally have condemned both sides, both the king and the Maoists. But with the coup, like both the king and the Maoists and the army, who are under the king, you know, for their abuses of human rights, the king was absolutely condemned for taking over the country. That was not seen as the correct move, with the exception of China, who he wined and dined prior to that. There were some restrictions on Tibetans in Nepal that were in place 2 weeks prior to the coup. And later on, we realized that that must have been sort of the candy that the king gave the Chinese government to sort of buy their support when he did take over. So there are a number of things along the way that looked like that. India also wants democracy in Nepal. So the two neighboring countries really have different positions on it. The vast majority of the EU has condemned Nepal for this, or has condemned the king. Most countries in the world are condemning the king, but he continues on.
Are you going to be speaking later today about this situation as well at Cafe Kathmandu?
Yes.
Great. So we'll point people towards that as well if they want to find out more. Thanks, Maddie, for coming in this morning.
Okay, thank you.
Maddie Burnaby is a high school teacher in Vancouver, and she'll be showing slides and speaking about her experiences in Nepal at Cafe Kathmandu at 2779 Commercial Drive.